the young lady that I asked to speak for us tonight, I've met her through service work. And one of the things that you guys keep telling me is that we don't realize that people are watching us. And for about 6 months, I've been going to Atlanta Intergroup, and I've seen our speaker there. And she shows up. Number one, she keeps her commitment, and that's important to me, because when I got here, my first sponsor told me the only way I could not keep a commitment is that I was either dead or in the hospital. So I'm always impressed when people show up. And whenever she opens her mouth, because sometimes those intergroup functions, well, any business meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous can get pretty hilarious. And what comes out of her mouth are the traditions. And with that, I'm going to introduce to you guys Laura Kay from the Serenity Group. Yes.
Hi, my name is Laura Z. I'm an alcoholic. She's new. It's always a pleasure. I hate these, but it's always a pleasure and an honor to ask to participate in anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wouldn't have said that to you a year ago. I got sober in 1991. I want to make sure I put that out there, because I sometimes tend to forget to let you all know where I am in my sobriety journey. So I've got 9 years, and this last year's been a long one, longer than the first 8, I think. And like I said, it's always an honor, and Wanda, thank you very much for asking me. And I really want to thank a couple of people in the audience who came to support me tonight, because I get nervous doing this. It's challenging to get up in front of a group of my peers, and you are my peers more than any peer that I have in my life that I walk. And it's important to me that I hopefully can carry some type of message. And I do this really for me more than I do it for you, believe it or not. But I do pray, and I got on my knees before I came up here tonight, that somebody, whether it just be me or one other person in the room tonight, gets something out of what it is I have to say. And I have no idea what that's going to be, which is another big change for me, because I'm used to being very prepared when I get in front of a group of people, and I stopped doing that a little over a year ago. So hopefully what comes out tonight is from my heart. That's also what I prayed for, and hopefully my emotions can come through, because I tend to shut them down at times. So I'm going to hopefully expose myself to you, because that will be very cleansing for me. How it was, what it was like, what it's like now, what I did to get here, I guess. I think I was a normal kid. I think I had a normal family. If you talk to my sister, she must have grown up in a different house, because her life was very dysfunctional. And the more that I'm sober, the more that I realize so is mine. I just kind of shut that down and didn't acknowledge it. It's one of the gifts of therapy. You know, you always say, well, I'm sure that came from your mother or your father. At least that's what I've done. And it's not in a way of blame. It's in a way of understanding, to change the path, to change the course, to not be that person, and to hopefully transcend above some of the yuckiness that went on in childhood. You know, it wasn't bad. Don't get me wrong. I had a wonderful childhood. My parents loved me and did everything that they possibly could do, I'm certain, for me and for my welfare. And there wasn't anything more that they could do. They did the best that they could with what they had. And they didn't have many tools. And they grew up in a very unhealthy situation themselves. So my mom was, at the age of 3, put in an orphanage. And what that meant was she didn't have parents until she was, I think, a junior in high school is when she came out. So she didn't have anyone hold her and love her and guide her and support her. She had Catholic nuns wrap her knuckles with the ruler when she wasn't obedient. So when she had her first child, holding, cuddling, loving was not normal for her. She didn't know how to do it, because she had never had that. And my father grew up with, they both had alcoholic fathers, but my father grew up with a fairly rageful, from what I can recall, father, who came here from Germany at a very young age, like 10, and I'm not sure of the age, but when he got here, he had to immediately go to work and didn't have a childhood, you know, as that whole generation really didn't. They really grew up in depression, in the depression. So they're hardcore, they're taught, you know, you work for whatever it is that you want, and your identity is your successes in your career, you know. And really what they did was they did enough to get by. So when I think about my parents and what they did for me, they did a good job. They did a really good job considering where they came from. And that's what I always try to remember when I feel that my mother is acting out. Yeah. I try to remember that she didn't have a parent until she was a junior in high school. In the same way with my dad, when he does things that just don't feel very loving to me, I try to find the love underneath it. I try to go past the defenses of whatever it is that he's putting out there and see that hurt little child, because I know that it's there. So growing up, like I said, I was normal. At age 10, I realized I was different. I didn't know how different. I just knew I was different in a lot of ways. And I think that's when I really began establishing this defense mechanism of shutting down and not feeling my emotions. And part of that was I'm sure it was learned from my parents, that when times are tough, you just don't feel them. And you grab your boots, and you pull them up, and you muscle down, and you get through it. Heaven forbid you cry or you expose any weaknesses, because that's just not acceptable. And so that's what I learned at a young age. And what happened at 10 was my dad bought me a motorcycle. And I had said that I wanted a motorcycle. It was for Christmas. Something about speed and being on wheels just really appealed to me. But what I didn't realize was that it was going to terrify the hell out of me. And a couple of days before Christmas, I found the motorcycle in the garage. And I remember going to my sister and saying, oh my gosh, I got a motorcycle and it's scary. And I was scared. And I acted surprised and I acted excited, because this is what you do. You know, you act the part. It's a gift. It's for mom and dad. You act the way you're supposed to act. And, you know, dad was proud and happy and tickled pink, given he didn't have any sons. He just had me and my sister, and he really wanted a son, so he kind of converted me to the son. And I played the role willingly. I was more than happy to be the tomboy of the family. So the next day after Christmas, he took me out to learn how to drive the motorcycle. And it's just recently that I realized how wrong that day was. Instead of me saying, Dad, I'm afraid, I got on the bike, I did that thing. I muscled down, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and I got on that bike and was terrified but rode it anyway to make my dad proud. And that's what I did. I lived for their expectations. Whatever they wanted me to do is what I tried to do to make them happy. And this was at age 10, so it only grew from there. I can tell you that now. It turned out that I loved the motorcycle. You know, those first couple of whatever days, weeks, were very scary. And then I became, you know, the little motorcycle, little 10-year-old that rode around with all the little boys in the neighborhood on his bike, and, you know, a real tough kid. A lot of stuff happened when I was a kid that, again, wonderful therapy. It's coming to surface now, and the motorcycle is just one little example of where I acted in ways that it's clear to me today why I act the way I do today. And my life and my challenge today is to undo some of that, to understand it and to not do it anymore. I don't want to walk through this life unfeeling and uncaring and unloving. I want to be able to walk through it. And if I'm hurt, I want to be able to cry. And if I'm sad, I want to be able to ask somebody to hold me. I want to be able to have all those feelings. And I want them to be my feelings and not what you want them to be for me. And I'm learning that, and I'm still learning that, and it's been a challenging year for me to learn that. And I'm going to jump around a lot, and I apologize, because I'm here, but I'm somewhat not either. like I said, it's a little intimidating looking out at all of you. So that was 10. I didn't start drinking until I was about 16, and that was at the age of 16. I'm also an overachiever, and I've always been that. At the age of 16, I got my driver's license, got my first car. Now, this is on my 16th birthday, and got my first job. Now, I did all of these things really to just get away from home. And by getting this first job, it gave me my first experience of freedom, I think. And what I would do at night was I would work at a restaurant and waiting tables, and I would tell my mom that I was closing the restaurant, which meant that I was working till 2, because the restaurant closed at 2 or 3. And really, I was getting off at about 10. And I would have my change of clothes, and I'd go out with my friends, and I would drink till about 2 or 3 and stumble in, and I would never know the difference, or at least I thought they didn't. And I'll tell you what, when I drank, I got to let all of those inhibitions down, and I started to feel like I could actually be me. Now remember, at age 10, I realized there's something wrong with me. At age 16, I'm thinking, oh, well, this is what's wrong with me. I just needed a little alcohol, just kind of like smooth out the edges, to be able to be who I really am. And that person at 16 who could really just let go of all guards, the letting go of all guards is part of what I'm doing today, and it's part of what I've learned how to do. It took alcohol to do it before. I was terrified. Yeah, at a young age, I was just a fearful person, afraid of people, afraid of things, afraid of consequences. I just walked through my life in a state of fear, basically. So at 16, I learned how to drink, and it was a wonderful thing. I also learned how to smoke, and that was a great thing, too. Smoking and drinking, I'm happy. My drinking didn't get really bad for quite a long time. I graduated high school and needed to get away from my parents as far as possible, so I moved away to college and went to... I grew up in St. Louis, and I went to Cape Girardeau, Missouri for 2 years of college. Well, actually, I kind of missed something here. And it's a big part of my story. That might have been on purpose. At 17, right after graduating from high school, I had another motorcycle. I graduated from that little 60cc. Does anybody know about motorcycles? I can really talk motorcycle. I graduated from my 60cc motorcycle to 100cc and then to a 250cc. So by the age of 17, I had a good bike. It was a Honda, and it was an Enduro, and I would ride it out at the country with where my cousins lived, and it was really just kind of a recreational thing. I never had it licensed for the road. I just ride it on trails and that. 17, I was out riding with my best friend on the back, and it was raining, and we were coming back down a dead-end road, and it started raining really hard, and I asked her, should we stop or should we go? You know, because we're like a quarter of a mile away from the house, but it's raining really pretty hard. And she said, let's go ahead and go. And I was like, yeah, I agree. Let's go ahead and go. And I had a ball cap on. And so I was using the ball cap to shield my eyes from the rain. And I was using the ball cap and the line on the right-hand side of the road to know where I was going. So my eyes were really not really seeing very far ahead of me. And up ahead, I saw there was a dump truck parked on the side of the road, half on the road, half on the side. And I saw it, and I knew I needed to go around it, and I went around it, but there was a piece of sheet metal hanging out the side of it. And the sheet metal clipped me, clipped my arm, clipped my friend's arm. And my arm was completely severed. My arm went in the ditch. I went about 100 yards farther. And my heart's racing here, because this is really kind of a... incredible that I lived through this and that I can stand here and tell you about it today. So I'm trying to tell it without a whole lot of feeling, but there's really a lot of emotions going on inside. So my friend got up and came over to me and said, where's your arm? And I stood up and we looked inside my shirt thinking maybe it had been in there. And it wasn't. And she went into the ditch and found it. And we walked up to the nearest house. Knocked on the door, my friend's carrying my arm and carrying me, and said, we need help. I just can't imagine what it was like to be on the other side of that door at that moment. I was in shock. I didn't know what was going on. So they called my parents. They called an ambulance service, and this was in a really small rural town outside of St. Louis. And they really don't have medical services there. And what they had was a, like, 80-year-old retired physician who could come out and start an IV to keep me alive, because the ambulance services can't start IVs. And so this 80-year-old physician shows up and puts this IV in me. We're 5 miles down the road heading towards St. Louis, and the IV falls out. Some of this is very comical when you think back on it. And the folks in the ambulance kept saying, or said to my mom, it is illegal for us to start this IV, but if you want us to, we will, but we will not take any responsibility. And, you know, my mom said, do it, of course. You know, I don't want my daughter to die. Do it. And got me to the hospital. I'm still in shock. And everyone that I encountered, I said, promise me that I will have my arm. Promise. And, you know, these poor physicians and nurses and whatever, residents, you know, here I am, this 17-year-old gorgeous girl, asking for a promise that they can't make. You know, and they will do the best we can. Which was enough for me. I held on to that. And went in for surgery, came out. Actually, what happened was once they got me to Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, which is the best hospital in the world, just so you know, they said they wouldn't reattach it. And my dad, who can be an arrogant son of a bitch, grabbed the doctor, and this is my dad, and he can be very violent, grabbed the doctor by the scrubs and said, you will try. And thank God my dad was inappropriate that day and at that time, because they were unwilling to try, and he said, you will. And that strength and that stubbornness of my father that I now have, I'm very grateful for, even though at times it can be one of my worst character defects. So they attempted. They were successful. Two arms. If you want to applaud, you can, because that's pretty good. When I came out of surgery and there was this big bundle next to me, I was sure everything was okay. I didn't have a clue as to what I was really facing at that point in time. And doctors are pretty smart about not letting you know everything up front. You know, they don't want to send you into a clinical depression immediately. They want you to, like, warm up to it before it happens. So I got out fairly quickly. That was when I was introduced to morphine, which that is really good stuff. If you've ever had morphine, it's the best. I would sit there. I'd get shots every 3 hours, and I would get my shot, fall asleep for about an hour and a half, and once I'd wake up, I'd pull out my watch and I'd watch it for that next 3 hour dose of morphine. And my first little clue was, you know, the nurses came in and they said, you know, you really need to start weaning yourself off the morphine, but not this alcoholic. I didn't hear that, and that really was my first sign that there's something wrong with this person. They were telling me, if you want to go home, you have to get off the morphine. And I was opting to stay at the hospital for the morphine. You know, that seemed like a good choice to me. I don't need to go home. I'll just stay here with the morphine. Anyway, they finally got me off of it. And what happened was, and this, again, it's like the longer I'm sober, the more that my past life is revealed to me. It's almost as though I went into blackouts in and out of parts of my life, even when I wasn't drinking. And I don't know if that makes sense, but my life just becomes more clarity. You know, you hear about clarity in here, and you just get more clarity the longer you're around. What I didn't realize until recently was that I really went into I did go into a clinical depression. And during that first little stay at the hospital, the physicians came over to my parents and said, she's going to need some help, some psychological help, and we will set you up for that. And my parents came to me and said, they think you need some some help, some psychological treatment, but we don't think so. What do you think? Now, this is the, I'll do anything to please you, to make you happy, whatever you think is best, I'm going to live up to your expectations, girl. Laying in a hospital with an arm that's about the size of the top of my leg from being swollen and just all the stuff that they pumped in it. And being told, yeah, they think you need it, but we don't, so, you know, I didn't have a choice. At that time, I just really did not have a choice. I did, in reality, but in my little mind, I didn't have a choice. My decision was already made by my parents. So, of course, I just said, well, no, I'm tough. I don't need help. Wow. Forget it. But like I said, the doctors are really good about easing reality into to people who go through dramatic things in their lives. Traumatic things. About 3 months later, they told me, well, you know, you're probably not going to be able to ever drive a stick shift again. You're probably not going to be able to move your wrist or your fingers, and we've got a whole lot of surgeries to do, and they may or may not be successful. Now, they didn't do all this in one setting. It was almost like every month or 2 months, they would give me a little bit more news. And basically what they did was they took parts from my entire body and put them into my arm to make my arm work again. Veins, muscles, nerves, skin, bone. I've got scars everywhere. Now, at the age of 17, where you should be living, you know, the prime of your life, I was going through surgeries for about 2 or 3 years. I was in and out of hospitals and drinking in between and coping with life without any psychological help whatsoever. And with parents that really, they really just didn't know what to do. And each time that I would get another blow from the physicians, you know, I would just stonewall more. I would just clam down and shut down just a little bit more, and I built up some really strong defenses. I don't know what happened, what triggered me out of it, but this is, for me, I learned acceptance prior to getting to this program. Because at about year 3, I was in such a state of depression, and I couldn't sleep at nights. I hated everything about me. I hated my body, I hated my personality, I hated who I was. I was a mess. And really, to me, it was my options were was suicide. And I never attempted suicide, but I felt like, you know, I can remember numerous times driving down the highway thinking, you know, just a little pull of the wheel and I run into that embankment and nobody will know the difference and it's well and good for me. And not caring that I'm drinking to a point of oblivion and possibly endangering myself and others. Just really not caring. I just had no desire to really live. And actually during one of my surgeries that was a really big one, it lasted almost 24 hours. They had a team of doctors work on me during that surgery. I came out of it and my doctor came up and said, how are you? And during that surgery, I could see myself. I died during that surgery, and when she asked that question of how are you, I said, I wish you would have let me die. I just didn't want to go on anymore. But anyway, what I was getting to was the acceptance piece, which was around year 3, so I was probably 20 years old. I realized that I had to live life on life's terms, and I didn't have a program. I just knew that if I didn't change my attitude, I was going to die. And it wasn't like I became like a really good person and my mental state changed. I just got to a point where I said, this depression thing is just not working. I still drank a lot, and I'm sure that the drinking helped me get to that point of acceptance. But it was really my best friend who loved me for who I was, who always said to me, it doesn't matter what your body looks like. It doesn't matter that to you, you look, you know, deformed. You're a very loving person, and I see your soul, and you have a lot of worth. And I never got that from my parents, and I got it from that friend. And that's what got me to the other side of it. So, anyway, went off to college, did the 2 years at Cape, then went to Springfield, Illinois, and did 2 years there. And then went on for my master's in Springfield. And at this time, my drinking started getting pretty heavy. And that's when I met my fiancé. My one and only fiancé that I had in my life. I always referred to him as my one fiancé because I had one. I'm really proud of that. what can I say? he and I both drank a lot, and we enjoyed drinking together. And, you know, I could tell you some of the stories, but I really don't want to go there because I don't want to spend my whole time talking about my drinking days. He and I came very close to getting married, and about 30 days prior to the wedding date, I called it off. And, you know, we had everything. We had the band, the invitations, the little matches with the little bears on it. We were ready to get married. I knew something was wrong. And I'm not sober yet, but I knew something was wrong, and it wasn't right for me. And so I called it off, and that was, for me, a very courageous thing to do because, you know, this, again, this is a person that lived by other people's expectations. And that's what this whole marriage thing was, you know, about. Everybody liked David. He was a great guy. He's going to be a great provider, blah, blah, blah. They're going to live happily ever after, have 2.5 kids, white picket fence, dogs, you know, the whole thing. But I knew something was wrong. And about, I don't know, 6 months, a year after that breakup, we were still seeing each other and still dating. And it was a Friday night, and I got really, really drunk, which I usually did on Fridays. By this point in time, I was drinking every day, and I had been for at least a year, maybe a year and a half. I could barely get through my work day, and I can remember sitting in the bathroom in the morning, feeling hungover, saying to myself, I'm not going to drink tonight. I just feel so shitty. I just can't do it again tonight. And then by noon, sitting in the bathroom again, thinking, was it really that bad last night? And then by 3 in the afternoon, you know, I get off work at 5, thinking, I cannot wait to get home to get another glass of scotch. I've just got to get home now. And that was first, I'd walk in that house, I wouldn't take off my shoes, nothing, I'd go straight to the scotch. Or gin, whatever the night was. Anyway, so David and I are having fish, and I'm drinking gin, and something snapped. I don't know what happened, but I hear of the spiritual awakenings, and I guess that's what happened for me. I just started crying. I didn't know why, but I just started crying. And you know, we were laying in bed, and I'm crying, and he's like, "What's going on?" And I said, "I can't drink anymore." And he was real supportive and said, "That's fine, I won't drink with you. You know, we can both quit together and, you know, we'll stop drinking." Because we both drank way too much. And I won't say he's an alcoholic. I can say that I am, but I won't say he was. Within 2 or 3 days, he was drinking again, and I wasn't. And prior to this, God has worked in my life from, I'm sure, ever. During my college days, I kind of suspected I drank more than, I knew that I drank more than most. And I did a research paper on alcoholism. You know, and it's like, so I knew what the solutions were years before that night where I just broke down in tears. And, again, going back to my parents who believe that you do things on your own, you don't need help. You're strong, you don't rely on others, you get through your stuff on your own. With all that running around in my head, AA was not an option. Because that was for weak people, and they were probably part of a cult, because that's what my parents told my sister, who's in the program, and had been at that time for about 3 years. And so that was not my solution. To come into AA. So I quit on my own, and I made it for about 30 days, and come July 4th weekend, I was ready to drink, and I was white-knuckling my way to the liquor store, and something came over me that said, go to an AA meeting, and if you still want to drink after that, you can, and I gave myself that permission. And so I went to my first AA meeting 30 days later. And I sat there, and those people, I have no idea what they said. They seemed to be happy, I guess. It was weird, just the strangest experience. What I do know is that I walked away that night and I didn't drink, and that it worked, that I didn't have to drink after going to that meeting. Now, I wasn't about to become some AA groupie. Mm-mm. All I need is a meeting once a month, something like that, right? So I went another couple of weeks, and I don't know how I stay sober that first year, because I was stubborn and did not want to become a part of it all. Only when I was desperate. And you know how when you get to that point where you're desperate, you're like insane. And you're that close, you're like right to the edge. That's what I would do on a regular basis during that first year of sobriety. I'd wait till I was right to the edge. You know, when you can go into a blackout and be at the liquor store and not even know it. That's how I lived my first year of sobriety, though. And it worked. And I got a sponsor. I did do that at around month 10 or 11. Really worked the program the way it was suggested to me. And thank God for June Haugen. June has, I think, about 30 years now. She got sober at a really young age, and she loved me, and she let me hang out with her on her front porch. And to this day, I have a picture of me and her on the front porch on my mantle, and that is that's where I found peace for the first time in my life without being drunk. And I would go over to her house, and I would just sit there, and she'd come out, and she'd say, "Do you want to talk?" I'd say, "No." She, "Okay, well, I'm going to go cook dinner. You can come in if you want." And I was like, "Okay." And I'd sit there, and she'd let me. I didn't have to participate in life. I didn't have to talk to her. I didn't have to fake how I felt. I just sat there and moped, and then eventually I'd feel okay, and I'd come in, or I'd come in, and I'd say, "This is what happened, and I'm pissed off, and I hate life, and blah, 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 blah." And she'd just sit there patiently and listen and didn't put any expectations on me at all. And it was my first experience of being unconditionally loved. Because I was a real asshole a lot of times during my first several years. I still can be, don't get me wrong. But she loved me. Unconditionally. I didn't have to prove anything to her. I still did. You know, part of the time when I was staying sober, it was to make her happy, but when push came to shove, I acted out in some really poor ways, and she still cared about me, and she still loved me, and she still let me come around, and it was a wonderful experience. And she's still in my life today. I still see her and talk to her, and she lives in San Francisco now, but we have not lost that bond. In fact, we talked on Sunday, and I told her how grateful I was that I'd met her and that she was still in my life, and she said, "Well, you're a keeper." She said, "It's really cool when you find keepers in your life." And I said, "Yeah, so are you." And it's true. We're keepers for each other. She will always be a part of my life as long as she's alive and I'm alive. So my first year of sobriety was, it was as soon as I got sober, David couldn't, my fiancé, and so that was the end of him. And that really worked out well because I needed a good reason to get rid of him anyway. So if he couldn't get sober, adios amigos. And I'll tell you what, it was great because I was single, I was alone, I was sober, I was happy. For the most part, other than that, you know, regular first year insanity that goes on when you're up and down and up and down. All in all, my first year of sobriety was a pretty good experience. And June taught me about the first few steps. And it was like right around year two. I did my first four step at around year one. And at that time, I really got honest, and my four-step to me wasn't a regular four-step. Everybody's is unique, but mine was, you know, I'm unique. That's all there is to it. I'm unique. All that I could put in my four-step, there was other stuff, but the big thing that I put in my four-step was that I thought that I might be gay. And that was one of the most painful things I've ever done in my life. And went to go tell her and do my fifth step. I kept postponing and postponing and postponing. Finally, she said, "You're going to do the fifth step. It's going to be Tuesday night. It's going to be at your house. It's going to be at 7 o'clock. I will be there. And if you are not there, I will find you. And we will do this." And so, you know, I did all my other regular BS stuff of, you know, and then I did, you know, the little stupid things that I'd done in my life that really weren't very big. And then when it came to the big one, I was pretty sure that she would look at me, scream, say, "You are not a lovable person," and leave and never talk to me again. And instead she cried. And then I cried. And she said, "What are you going to do now?" And I said, "I don't know, because I don't know. What do people do? I don't know." And she said, "Well, you know, let's pray." And we prayed. And over the course of the next year, we talked a lot about that and talked about what that meant to me and how that would impact my life and how that would affect my parents and
and who I am and all of that stuff. And we decided that, actually I decided, she helped me see the solution, that I couldn't be gay in Springfield, Illinois. So I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. My sister lives here. And so that was my big, I moved here to be gay. That was 7 years ago. Within the first 6 months, I went to my first gay AA meeting, and we don't have enough time to go through it all, so I won't. But the reason that I need to share this today is because it is not to distance myself from you, which is what I heard from another gay speaker once before, but to let you know that that's what the program of AA has given me. It has given me the freedom to be me, even though I've been wrapped up through my whole life of living far the expectations of other people. It's given me the freedom to be honest with you, which is pretty terrifying right now. I'm real happy no one's getting up and leaving, because that's always a fear of mine. It's still a big challenge for me. And I'm not gay in my career. I'm gay in AA. And I'm gay finally with my parents. It took me about 3 years to tell them, which they didn't take well, but that's okay. They're growing as I'm growing too. They still accept me. When I ended my first relationship in sobriety, my first gay relationship, they said, are you going to go find a nice boy now to date? You know, they don't want to see that. They would rather that I have the white picket fence and the husband. And that's what they were taught growing up. I don't criticize them for their opinions and their beliefs. I try to love them past that. But I also don't change who I am today for them either. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I kept drinking. I would say over the last year, my life has totally changed. And all of those things that I described about living up to other people's expectations has really hit me hard over the last year and a half. I ended my first gay relationship about a year and a half ago, and that was a 6-year relationship. And when I moved here, I started my own company in a career that I hadn't worked in before. Again, I'm an overachiever. That's what I do in my life. Over the last 3 months, my company has went from being a thriving, growing, successful company to possibly needing to close its doors. And somewhere in all of this, there's some great lessons to be learned. And it's another opportunity. I feel like a newcomer again because I'm raw. I wrapped my identity up in my company, and my career means almost as much to me as my sobriety. My mom and I were talking over Thanksgiving to this woman, and we were talking about this woman's kids and how rotten they were. They were teenagers. And my mom said something like, well, you know, I've got a great daughter here. And the woman said, well, what is it about you that's great? And I said, well, I own my own company. And then she looked at me like, and? And my mom and I looked at each other like, does she need to know more? So I don't know what this is about with everywhere I'm turning in my company right now, doors are shutting. And I really have to put a lot of faith in God right now, and I want so badly to walk through this with grace and dignity, and I'm trying very hard. I don't want to do it the way I got sober, and I don't want to do it the way that it was really messy when I started the company. And it feels different, and it is different. What I'm going through right now, my therapist is wonderful. My therapist told me the other night that, you know, you might want to think about getting on medication. I'm like, no way, Jose. This tough little broad is not going to get on meds. I'm going to feel this. I'm going to get through it. And it really what it's about for me is I don't want to shut down and dull my senses over what I'm going through. I want to go through it, and I want to try to feel it. I really want to have my heart get the opportunity to know what it is I'm going through and to give God the opportunity to show me some new stuff. I have no idea where he wants me to go, but I'm showing up, and I'm putting one foot in front of the other, and I'm not smoking, and I'm not drinking. And I quit smoking 2 years ago, and that is as big a deal to me today as not drinking. If you've ever been a smoker and you quit, you know what I'm talking about. or if you're trying to quit, and I know people that are, and it's a very respectable thing to try to quit smoking. For the first time in sobriety, I've really learned what it means to be humble. And I never would have thought that giving back to the program would give me as much joy as it gives me today, and that it would take away my misery. Wouldn't have been able to tell me that. So, this journey has been a great one. And we've got about 8 minutes. So what I want to do is read one of my favorite paragraphs out of the 12 and 12. Are there any questions? You can catch me after the meeting if I left stuff out or I didn't make sense. Or if you're thinking about being gay and you don't know how to come out, I'm here for you. This is out of step 11. Page 99, and it is, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven, and it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. That's what's kept me sober for the last year, is what that says right there. And I hope that it was as good for you as it was for me. Thank you very much.